welcome to the House of Comments podcast. This is a regular podcast featuring me, Lib Dem blogger Mark Thompson, and also regularly featuring my co-host, Labour blogger Emma Burnell. Good evening, Emma.
Hi, Mark.
We thought we'd start with the Royal Charter, which I think I'm right in saying received royal assent this week on Wednesday. So there was a last-ditch attempt by...
Queen, she say yes.
Yeah, Queenie. Yeah, we activated the Queen. I think a selection of members of the Fourth Estate clubbed together and tried to appeal it, but their appeal failed on Wednesday. There was some technicality they were trying to appeal it on. So, yeah, so it's received royal assent. And basically, this means now that there is this legal framework in place that they now want the press to sign up to. But if I understand correctly, because I've read a couple of pieces that have basically said it's all very well with this legal thing being in place, but actually, if none of the press actually sign up to it, then it's not going to have any effect anyway. They still actually need to sign up to it. So I think the press in the background are still plugging away, getting on with their own thing, which I've always found a bit weird. I can't really think of any other situation where the government's legislating for something and then, like, a body that would be affected by that legislation goes, do you know what, we're just going to ignore this legislation, we're going to do our own thing, is that all right?
Or not even say,
is that all right, just do it.
If they don't sign up for it, the damages that they might be sued for would be far more punitive.
Yeah.
Whereas if they sign up for it, it acts as insurance against that kind of stuff, so they might be sued for a lot less.
Mm.
But it does need a certain amount of momentum, and it'll need a certain amount of the press to sign up for it in order to, you know, be real.
Mm. I suppose the problem is if literally none of the press sign up for it, then it actually will have no effect, I would guess, because they're all kind of standing together. But if some of them start to sign up for it, then they're the ones who will have the protections. Okay, so they'll have to abide by the rules of it, but they'll have the legal protections in place and the other papers won't, or magazines won't. And then there's the risk that if something happens, they could end up out of business because there's no limit on the damages that can be claimed from them. I think that's right, isn't it?
I think that's basically the idea behind it, yeah.
Mm. So, I mean, what do you think about this, Emma? Are you happy that this has been brought in? And do you think that the majority of papers and magazines will ultimately sign up to it?
I am happy that it's been brought in. I think the press have been drinking in the Last Chance Saloon since I was born, and I'm nearly 40. That's a little bit of trivia for the listeners out there who thought I was 21.
Also, nice little coining of David Meller's catchphrase from the early 90s.
Yeah. Well, I remember that because I'm very old.
Me too.
So, I think it's about time that something changed. A good example of why we need to have a stronger system of apologies and retractions, for example, came from very helpfully from The Sun this week, where they printed a tiny, 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 tiny clarification on the fact that their front page story of 6,000...
No, 600,000,
I do apologise. Health tourists turned out to be made up.
Yeah.
There was no basis for it at all.
I love the way the apology said, we said it was 600,000 and that was wrong. And we said there was another thing they said that was completely wrong and that was wrong. It's basically everything in the story.
Everything in the story was wrong. Yeah. And that story had been run with by, you know, been mentioned in the House of Commons, it, you know, been run with by lots and lots of people. And it was bullshit.
Yeah.
And that's not a free press. That's a fake press.
Yeah, but I mean, I suppose...
Yes, you're going to bring in a system whereby if a story is wrong, it has to have the same prominence as the original story. I think that that's a good example of why it's necessary.
Yeah, when we had Toby Young on the other week, that was the one point that he conceded. I'm not sure he would have conceded exactly the same prominence, but he did concede that the fact that you have, like, you know, front page splash, massive headlines, and then on page 27, a tiny little paragraph somewhere where no one ever sees it. I would love to see some research, actually, on the number of people, when it comes to some story like that, you know, who, when they've seen the original story and then with the retraction afterwards, how many of them still believe the original story because they saw that story and then they never saw the retraction. You must
think of how many people still believe that Birmingham have banned Christmas.
Well, exactly. I mean, I think it's the kind of thing that Ben Goldacre, I think, has referred to before as kind of zombie stories that just keep coming back and coming back and coming back. No matter how often they're rebutted, they just keep coming back. And I think it's part of the problem. I mean, I suppose what the Sun would argue is, we put it on the same page, because I think that story was originally on page two and the apology was on page two. But I wouldn't say that was equal prominence, because the original story must have covered most of the page, whereas the retraction was, you know, one column that was about an inch high.
Yeah.
So that's not equal prominence. What they should have done, and what I would argue for, and it might seem a bit extreme, is to literally be forced in the same font, in the same typeface size, to have a banner headline, "We were wrong on such and such." So it's exactly the same. Because the effect of that would be pretty quickly, they'd stop doing it, because they'd be so embarrassed by it. But that's why they won't do it, you see. And that's why them setting their own rules like this, I just ultimately don't think will work, because they're not going to do things like that to embarrass themselves. They're addicted to these kind of stories. They're not going to stop printing these sort of stories, no matter what. So that's why I think actually some of them won't sign up to this new charter, because I just don't think they're going to be able to.
Well, no, but if they don't, I think the press are behaving very childishly, very childishly, en masse. They're behaving like toddlers who are throwing their toys out the pram, having a hissy fit. And they are their own worst enemy, because if they don't sign up to this, which is so light touch, then you know, what's going to happen next time there's a big scandal? Which will happen because it's unregulated, because they haven't signed up to this charter. It will just be hit with something much, much harder and much worse, which, you know, is actually not something I want to see. I want them to work within this light touch system. But if they refuse to even take heed even of this, then they have only themselves to blame if people say, well, if you won't listen to that, then we will properly legislate to ensure that the truth gets out.
There was a good piece on political betting either yesterday or today by David Herdson. I don't know if you read it. He tends to write quite kind of long form essay pieces for political betting rather than the shorter pieces they normally have on there. And he was basically saying that, you know, the press just don't get it. Do they not understand? We're not here because of politicians deciding they want to bully the press. We're here because of phone hacking, because of Millie Dowler's voicemail being hacked, because of the way the McCanns were treated. You know, that's why we're here, you know, and all the other hundreds. That, I mean, OK, so I know that the main spokespeople in the press who really hate this idea of regulation, they love to attack Hacked Off, and they love to attack Hugh Grant, and they love to attack Steve Coogan. And, you know, those people are celebrities. And frankly, I don't think many people did give a toss about whether Steve Coogan's private life has been, you know, whether his voicemails have been hacked into, whether his private life's been splashed all over the papers. And I don't think many people gave a toss whether Hugh Grant's private life had been splashed all over the papers either. But they've made themselves targets, and I think very bravely, because I know Steve Coogan is a very private person. He didn't want this fight, but he feels like he has to take up the cudgels because of the way he's been treated, and he does have quite a high profile to be able to do it. But it's not about the celebrities, just because they might help to drive the campaign forward. It's not about them. It's about the thousands and thousands of people whose lives have been destroyed by the press.
It's about Chris Jeffries. It's about Millie Dowler and Sarah Payne and her poor mother, who was used by both sides from the press. You know, they gave her the phone they were hacking.
Yeah. And I'm sure I've mentioned it before, but David Scarborough, he played the original Mark Fowler on EastEnders. Mm. And he had a lot of problems, and he ended up in a psychiatric hospital, I think, at points. And they were, you know, they were taking long lens photos of the psychiatric hospital. This was the News of the World back in the late 80s, taking long lens photos of the hospital, trying to get pictures of him, splashing it all over the papers. He ended up killing himself. Now, there's no way of knowing whether that was because of what the press did, but it can't have helped. You know, why were the press doing it? He was mentally ill. I think about Denham Elliott's daughter. I think her name was Jennifer. She was living on the streets. I think she had drug problems. She'd hit on hard times. They had splashed her all over the papers. And she also died. I think she killed herself as well. I don't know. I think sometimes people in the press, they don't realise the consequences of their actions, because they live in this world where it's all a bit of a game. And it's all a bit of a, we'll send a few paps out to take a few snaps, and we'll doorstep them for a couple of days. It's all just part of the game. What they don't realise is that they're messing with people's lives. And, you know, that's
like
the point.
That poor teacher who was transgender and was attacked horribly. And, you know, we cannot say that the attack, that her suicide was only down to the attack, but it was mentioned by the coroner in her inquest. It was quite unusual that the attacks on her by Richard Littlejohn and the Daily Mail contributed to her state of mind.
Yeah, I think some statements from her family since have slightly contradicted what the coroner said. And, I think, as you said before, there were so many complex reasons for
Absolutely.
people
You
committing
cannot
suicide.
attribute suicide to one cause because it's a very, very complex decision that is not, there is no linear cause and effect. It's a horrible thing of, it's a culmination of lots of dreadful things.
But all I can say is if I was in psychological dire straits and suddenly whatever was wrong with me was being splashed all over the papers, I'm telling you now, that would definitely make me feel worse. It wouldn't make me feel better. It wouldn't help. It would make it worse. And the last thing
Well,
I
and
should
also,
do with
if
someone.
you've ever had bad times in your life or you've made mistakes in your life, let's say that I suddenly, age 39-ish, nearly 39, decide to change course entirely and become a Hollywood actress. This is obviously something that could happen immediately. And
I'm looking forward to your first film.
me too. but the 40 years that I've spent making mistakes would bear nothing on my ability to do my job well as an actress. Or, in fact, if I decided to become an MP, it would bear nothing on my ability. It may even help me to be an MP because I understand the mistakes that people make. But lots and lots of people, myself included, would decide, you know what, it is not worth the hassle to go out there and put yourself into public life just to be attacked constantly.
Okay, but let there's a little bit too much consensus here because we haven't got anyone on to bat for the other side in this debate. So let's just look at the arguments from the other side. So what about the fact that they will claim that this is politicians interfering in what has hitherto been a free press for hundreds of years, and that basically, it would have a chilling effect, that the press will be worried about publishing stories about politicians because you never know what's going to happen next. And actually, you have people like Maria Miller who have made veiled comments along those lines as well, which have obviously worried some in the press. I mean, what are
Well,
your
yeah,
thoughts
that
on
was
that?
bloody stupid of Maria Miller because she shouldn't have done that. And as far as I can tell, this system is politicians will appoint people to oversee. Now, those politicians who appoint should be cross-party. It's important that we do try to make this work for the press. It is vital that we have a free press that are there to and able to investigate political wrongdoing and political misdemeanors, and politicians behaving in such ways that expose their hypocrisies. But I don't really think this is politicians interfering in the press. It's at such a remove that I think that's quite a spurious argument.
Okay, but I mean, isn't there a risk that even if the current government, and I suspect some in the press would argue that actually this current government couldn't be trusted, but even if you think the current government could, isn't there a risk that once you have these rules in place that future governments could extend? I mean, you actually yourself earlier in the discussion talked about the ratchet could be tightened later, and I know you were talking about that in the context of if they don't accept this and then something happens, then later there will be even tougher legislation. But the truth is, once legislation is in place, it's actually easier to turn the ratchet on the existing legislation than to have to introduce new legislation. And in fact, I think there are things like statutory instruments, aren't there, that governments can use. So once legislation's in place, they may not even have to go to the Commons and have it debated and have it, properly publicised. They could just behind the scenes tweak things and tighten things up and make it harder for the press. And we know for a fact that most politicians who end up in senior office and certainly Prime Minister are obsessed with the press. You've only got to read Damien McBride's memoirs to hear how obsessed Gordon Brown was with the press. I'd be amazed if Cameron was any different. We know how
Well, that's why he
slavish.
kept Coulson in place for so long, wasn't he? Because he felt he got him good press.
Exactly. And when the memoirs come out, I'm sure we'll get all the gory details, and I doubt it will be any different from the level of intensity of Brown and Blair before him. And we know John Major was, constantly beleaguered by the press, and he did used to read it. I'm not sure what Thatcher's attitude to it was. She probably didn't care. But the fact that politicians and prime ministers pay such close attention to what's in the press, isn't the temptation going to be, if they have these powers, to use them to lean on people, to use them as leverage to get more, more favourable coverage?
But it's my understanding that that's why they went for the Royal Charter option, because that's much, much harder to amend later.
Right.
I mean, I may be wrong. I don't know the ins and outs of how this all works. But as I understand it, that's the reason for this option is because it's much, much harder to fiddle with. It's a set of rules that would need a great deal of work to change. And it's not an ideal situation, but it's because it's basically the lesser of two evils, to be quite honest. You know, you've got the current setup, which simply has failed the public so massively that we've now got a slightly less worse option. And I'm afraid the only people who don't think so are those who have a financial interest in being able to tell nasty stories.
Okay, well, I've done my devil's advocate bit. I mean, I basically agree with this. And just to defend it on kind of, you know, liberal grounds, because I know some people will say, what kind of a liberal are you if you're willing to, you know, have state control of the press, as they'll no doubt term it, even though I agree with you, it isn't state control of the press. It is that, I think, I've seen the phrase, I think Hugh Grant coined it, dab of statute, just so that it has a statutory underpinning, even though the actual, the way that this is implemented is going to follow along the lines of Leveson, and the press are going to be heavily involved in how it works anyway, because they have to be, because it has to be workable. I mean, no one wants a situation where the press can't report on things anymore. Just to defend, I mean, you know, I think it's a perfectly defensible liberal position to say that you want to make sure that when the press reports on things, they do things, they do so fairly, and they do so in a way that, you know, protects minorities and people are entitled to a private life. And you see things like children of celebrities being reported on, and also, you know, there are all kinds of reasons why you might want there to be some kinds of rules in place about what the press can and can't do. And if the press won't do it themselves, and they have had decades to do it, let's not forget, this has happened over and over again. You know, we referred to David Meller earlier on. That was in about 1991. Mm-hmm. You know, he was talking about they were drinking in the Last Chance Saloon. And, you know, and it turned out that some of the stuff they published about him was a load of bollocks as well. I mean, again, like Hugh Grant and Steve Coogan, people might not have a lot of sympathy with David Meller. I know he's still very bitter about this. I've sat in radio studios with him and talked to him about it. You can see he bears the scars on his back from it. But, you know, I don't think he expects any sympathy either. But the point is, the press shouldn't be allowed to just go around making up stuff about people and getting away with it. That's the problem. If they didn't do it, we wouldn't need the rules and regulations. And I think that's a perfectly defensible liberal principle.
I completely agree. It's like the endless liberal tension between freedom from and freedom to. And I think for far, far too long, it's been biased in favour of freedom to rather than freedom from. And it's just a rebalancing of those two liberal principles.
OK, let's stop this loving. Maybe we can find something we disagree on. So should we talk about the living wage, which Labour has now finally, after lots of showing of ankle and fluttering of eyelids, has finally popped. What have they popped with, Emma? Do you want to fill us in?
Yeah, basically it's Living Wage Week in this coming week. So that's a celebration of and promotion of all things living wage.
Hang on, who decided it's living? Is this like when it's hot air ballooning week? Is it like one of these things now every year?
Yeah, I believe so. I think it's the Living Wage Foundation.
Right, okay.
Who are an independent body who check whether your company can be certified as a living wage employer, of which I'm very proud to say that my small training company, of which I'm a director, is. And they check not just your direct employees, but also people like if the building you work in hires a cleaning firm, they need to also be living wage employees. And that's how you get certification as a living wage employee.
Just to be clear, just before you carry on, so when you say living wage, are they just talking about the hourly rate? They're not talking about whether the companies then employ people for enough hours during the week for the wage to be considered to be a livable wage across the entire week, month, year. They're just talking about the hourly rate. So it might be that an employer considers themselves a living wage employer, but actually they have lots of people who only employ for 2 days a week. They pay them a living wage rate. They might not have any other job. So actually they might not effectively be on a living wage, but they would still be considered to have that badge.
Well, they're on a living wage for a part-time employee. Whether their other job or the other time that they spend is spent at a living wage cost, that's a separate issue.
Right.
But they are paid a living wage for an hourly rate.
Okay.
So what's happened is that Labour have come out with new proposals saying that in their first year of government, for 1 year, they will offer any business that moves to become a living wage employer a tax rebate of up to, I I think it's up to £1,000 for each employee that that they move to a from the minimum wage or from below living wage to a living wage on their national insurance and their tax.
Yeah.
So obviously the idea is that you there are many benefits to a business of being a living wage employer in terms of reputation or in terms of retention of staff, etc., etc. But it can be, you know, if it's a big hike in wages, it can be quite sort of off-putting, particularly for a small business. So the idea is to help get them over that first hurdle and support them through the first year. It's completely costed within terms of what is saved on tax credits. So the cost of doing this would be more than recouped for the through the toss of tax credits and things. So it's basically putting the onus on businesses to pay well and shifting the support of low-paid employees to the people who employ them rather than from the state.
Okay. Is there going to be a London waiting for this?
I don't know. I haven't seen that detail, but I'm guessing so because you don't get living wage accreditation in London unless you're paying the London living wage.
Okay. And are they going to have a reduced level of living wage in other parts of the country where the cost of living is lower? So like, say,
No, there are two. This is done, as I understand it, it's done with the Living Wage Foundation and with KPMG. Who, to be fair, KPMG have been a living wage employer since, I think, 2006. There are two levels of living wage. There's the living wage for London and there's living wage for outside of London. In the same way that you get London waiting, there are two levels of living wage and that's what it will be done on.
OK, but where I live in Berkshire, the cost of living is much higher than, say, where I come from originally, which is Runcorn in the northwest. So why should the living wage be set at the same level in both of those places?
I'm not the living wage economist at the Living Wage Foundation. They say that it works primarily outside of London the same because actually once you get out of the cauldron that is London, then travel and rent in particular are just much, much lower costs everywhere else. They may be differentials between Berkshire and the Northwest, but they're not as hiked as the differential between even Berkshire and London.
You see, I'm a bit scared. Well, I'm not an expert on this, but I know because I know people who live in the Northwest and I know people who live around here, including me, and I know the cost of living is more down here. And it strikes me that, I mean, I don't think, and you know, sometimes you hear people say about, well, we should reduce the minimum wage in other areas. And I don't agree with that. And you can't start reducing people's wages. That's not right. And even if you let them wither on the vine, that's also not right. But if we're going to move from a situation where we have a minimum wage to where we have a living wage, it makes sense, as far as I'm concerned, to try and pitch that living wage at a level that is actually a reasonable living wage. And what's a living wage in one part of the country isn't going to be, it can't possibly be the same all around the country. And it strikes me that whoever's done these calculations hasn't done a very good job. And it strikes me that actually, if they're going to set it the same all around the country, then it's kind of ideological rather than, you know, because they've costed it, because I don't think they can have costed it. That doesn't make any sense to me.
Are you saying you don't believe the Living Wage Foundation have properly costed the living wage?
If they're not taking into account cost of living differences between Berkshire and Cheshire, then yes, I think they've done their job properly.
Cheshire's a bad example because actually house prices in Cheshire are huge.
Yeah, but not in Runcorn where I'm from. So, you know, let's talk about Runcorn.
But actually, I mean, it's quite possible what they've done is set a living wage that is the higher end of that. I mean, I don't know. I don't know the Living Wage Foundation. I don't work there, but they are independent experts backed up by KPMG. I'm more likely to trust their calculations than your sense that things might be wrong because you've lived in two parts of the country.
Well, I would not necessarily just defer to authority because they've got the Living Wage Foundation above their door. If I don't think that they've done a very robust job, and I don't think they have in this
case. I haven't heard you give any evidence that they haven't done a robust job. What is wrong with their figures?
Well, going down the pub, you know, pints of beer around here cost more than they do in Runcorn. And I know that for a fact because I've been out in both places. You know, you're not talking about a huge amount. It's maybe 10, 15% difference, but there's a definite difference. And I know that house prices are much more expensive down here than they are up there. And I know that rents are more expensive up there than they are down.
How do you know how they've set the living wage and where they've set it for the people who live in your area? Whether they've maybe given the people in Cheshire a little more leeway than perhaps they've gone right up to the leeway of people in Berkshire.
Why would they do that though? Why wouldn't they set it to it? It's supposed to be a living wage, not an average living wage.
Works.
Well, you see, do you think that this is because of the principle? Because actually, if they started saying, well, in Berkshire it'll be this, and in Cheshire it'll be this, and in, you know, Northamptonshire it'll be this, that actually it just becomes too unwieldy and difficult, and you start ending up with people who live in one place, you know, live in one county but work in another county, and so on. And it would just be so impractical, actually. Just for practicality reasons, they've said, look, we'll say for London, because that's a one-off special case where things are very, very expensive, but the rest of the country, it's just all going to be the same. It strikes me that that's why they've done it.
I don't think that they would think that sloppily. I think they've done put a great deal of work into working out what the living wage has to be. They raise it every year. They work out what it has to be every year. They do so with some of the best accountants in the country, based on the best information that comes out of the Office of National Statistics. I don't think they have done it that sloppily. I think it's very easy, because this policy has come out of Labour, for you to go, oh, I don't like it because it probably doesn't work. But actually, what we've got here are two separate things. You've got some independent experts who are offering advice, and a party willing to take that advice. And a party willing to say, well, OK, here's how we can apply that advice in a practical way that will make a positive difference to business, a positive difference to people on low wages, and a positive difference to the Treasury. You know, win, win, win. Okay. I'm sorry that you're not keen that on the party that's done that, but that's not a reason to start suddenly deciding that KPMG and the Living Wage Foundation can't do their sums.
Well, I think you know, Emma, from many discussions on this podcast, that there are often policies of my own party in this government that I also don't agree with, and I will question and I will scrutinise. So I'm not just saying this because it's Labour. I'm saying it because it doesn't feel like they've done a particularly robust job. But let's move on from that, because that's just my quibble. To the politics of this. So do you think that this will herald a new dawn of the majority of companies across the country adopting the living wage if Labour get in? Because it sounds like they're not forcing companies to do it, but they're giving them quite strong incentives. And it strikes me that even though they're only saying for the first year, once companies have introduced a living wage and followed this and got the tax rebate for the first year, they can't then start dropping people's wages after the first year.
No.
So it will embed that culturally within a lot of companies.
That's the idea, yeah.
Okay.
I think it will change a lot of companies. I don't think it'll change every company, but it will then, once the employment market becomes more competitive, it will make those employers much more attractive to people when they're competing over people coming to work for them. I think that it will embed more of a culture of valuing work in the right way. I think it needs to be backed up with other measures, like, for example, having it contracted into any procurement, any government or local government procurement, that people should be paid a living wage on any contract that comes out. I think those kind of measures can also help to make this work. But I think in and of itself, yeah, it's a good policy. It's a good policy that will start shifting our understanding of the value of work in the right direction. It's pre-distribution, which is, you know, been very much a seminar topic. It's now actually saying, well, this is how this really works for real people's real wages. I think that's really important.
Yeah, I read your piece that you wrote about that, actually. Okay, so I'm starting to see battle lines for the next general election being drawn here. I don't know whether either of the other two main parties are going to go for this. I suspect the Tories won't. I can't really predict whether the Lib Dems will.
They've already been. I mean, as I saw Tim Farron being very snippy about it and saying it's state action rather than freedom for business, and we've stopped people paying taxes, so it doesn't really matter anyway.
Yeah, possibly, but I would imagine that any putative coalition negotiations between the Lib Dems and Labour, this is the kind of policy that would be quite easy for the Lib Dems to compromise on, because it doesn't really. Okay, so Farron's found a way of arguing with it, a little bit like I did, although I wasn't finding a way. That was a way I actually genuinely did think needed.
Well, you gave yourself away then, Mark.
No. I don't operate like that. You know I don't operate like that. But, you know, Farron's a senior Lib Dem and he has to kind of play these sort of games. But I'd imagine that it would be something fairly negotiable, let's put it that way. But the battle lines that I'm starting to see drawn here are that I think that both the Tories and the Lib Dems are going to go for, over the course of the next Parliament, the income tax rates moving from 10,000, which they will be at by that stage, to 12,500, which would effectively mean for the people earning that amount of money, if the minimum wage was to remain the same amount as it is now, and maybe just go up with inflation, the effect would be roughly the same. It would be roughly the same as those people having the living wage. So how's Labour going to counter that, do you think?
I don't think it will be the same, because we've seen wages in real terms go down 39 out of 40 months over the last, without, which includes the increases in the personal allowance. So actually, in real terms, wages are going down, and they have been going down for a long time. It's not just under the coalition, although it's been accelerated under the coalition.
Are you sure that includes the changes in the allowance? That doesn't sound right.
It does, yeah. Real wages have gone down overall in terms of the differential between real wages and price increases. And the thing about the living wage is it raises with the cost of things.
Right. Okay. So, but do you agree with me that they are? That's likely to be the battle lines? Because actually, I think the Lib Dems, if the Tories go for 12,500, I think the Lib Dems will probably go even further. And Lib Dems might say something like, and also we'll abolish national insurance below that level as well. Which I think, you know, it always seems a bit strange to me that you separate out tax and national insurance, but then they all just go into the same pot anyway. It seems like a bit of a misnomer to me. And that's maybe an anomaly that needs to be sorted out as well. But do you think that they are going to be the battle lines? And do you think that Labour will have the upper...
No, I think the battle line is going to be cost of living versus the economy. I think that's where whether economic growth is shared is what's going to be the battle line. Mm. The Tories and the Lib Dems are going to go, look, the economy's now growing, la la la, everything's great. And Labour are going to go, well, not for most people, it's not.
Mm.
And that, I think, quite clearly since September, that's where we've seen the battle lines going.
Okay, so what do you think some of these recalcitrant employers who decide, never mind about the £1,000 rebate in the first year, because they're looking 5 years hence and they're thinking, we don't want to lock ourselves into a situation where, you know, all these people that were currently paying minimum wage, because there are some companies out there who literally pay almost their entire, almost all their employees minimum wage. So it would be a massive increase in their cost base if they were to do this, once you discount the first year rebate. What's going to happen to them? Aren't they likely to actually be more competitive against the companies that do go for the living wage? There's almost an argument for saying it should be everyone or it should be no one, isn't there?
I don't think that's the case, because if you're saying it's everybody or it's no one, either you compulsorily make lots of people pay stuff that they can't yet afford, or you create the conditions in which when they start having to compete for employees, in order to do so, they have to pay a decent wage. And actually, you know, that's far less compulsion, far less, you know, state intervention, if you like, as a Liberal, than just saying everybody has to pay this. I mean, in an ideal world, the minimum wage should be a living wage. We don't yet live there, and we don't yet have an economy that is competing for employees. But we will get back to that. And when we do, those employers who have had the foresight to set themselves up and to budget this in will be the ones who are in the better position.
Well, I mean, you mentioned earlier on that you, you're a director of a company that does pay the living wage. And so am I. Well, actually, we've never signed up to anything, but everyone we've ever employed, we've always paid more than the living wage. I mean, and actually, it's based in London, and I'm sure we've paid more than the London waiting for the living wage. Maybe it's because of the type of the business that we are. It's fairly highly skilled and specialised.
Does that include your cleaners?
We don't actually directly pay any cleaners. So we just pay whatever the rates are for the building, and then they get sorted out for us. So they probably are paid minimum wage, but, you know, we don't have any direct control over that.
You do, because you employ the people who contract that cleaning to. You offer them a contract.
We don't. We just pay. We rent the building, and we just pay the people who own the building, and they sort out the cleaners. We don't have anything to do with it. You know, and I think that generally companies that pay higher wages get better staff. I'm sure that's right. And you know, that's certainly been my experience over the years. But I still have this niggling concern that there are going to be companies out there working in very, very competitive fields where an extra 5, 10, 15% on the wage bill is going to make all the difference between sinking and swimming.
Well,
and actually, Emma, my fear is not so much that will happen. It's that lots of particular types of industries won't sign up for this, because they'll all know that if any one of them individually does and all the rest don't, that they'll just be killed in the marketplace because they'll go out of business. Because the living wage companies won't be able to compete with them, and the ones who don't pay the living wage will just be able to undercut them and win all the contracts.
Well, I think, A, that's quite a simplistic way of looking at those costs, because you're not taking in any of the costs that come with a massive turnover of staff, i.e. training, people not being, you know, taking a while to get to the peak of what they're good at.
Yeah, I think you're generally talking about jobs
for new staff.
I think you're generally talking about jobs that are pretty low skill, though, that don't require lots and lots.
Even low skill jobs, you have to get better at them. You know, low skill is frankly a misnomer most of the time. even cleaning, or you know, you get better at it. You can do a cleaning job quicker the more often you do it. You know, these low skill is a misnomer. And actually, these businesses are looking at reputational damage for not doing it. If they are the ones who then take the lead, they may find that they are better able to compete when going for contracts, when trying to, you know, work with their CSR. There's a reason that companies pay a fortune for CSR, and that's because these things are important to people when they're purchasing in large bulk.
Yeah, I think, though, you might be being a bit optimistic about when contracts are being won, what they focus on. I think they generally focus on the bottom line.
But the bottom line over time is different from the bottom line as an immediate hit. And we've learned that quite well from things that have happened, particularly some of the failings of the last government in terms of PFI. You know, actually, the bottom line, if you can guarantee that more, and you may be well able to, if you've got a more stable workforce, then that's actually could be over time a saving rather than a cost.
Yeah, and I'm not denying that. I actually agree with that. What I was just going to mention is what I've mentioned before in this podcast, a book that Polly Toynbee wrote about 10 years ago called Hard Work, where she spent a year working in the type of jobs that we're talking about. And some of the stuff that she wrote in that book is, well, it's not unbelievable, sadly, but it really gives you an insight into how that world works. And she said it was just so depressing. There was one job she was doing where she was just literally ringing up, harassing people who already had cleaning contracts with one company to try and get them to come and use them for very, very slightly less money. And then when they won the contracts, all the people who worked for the other company would be sacked. And then they'd employ all of those people at probably slightly less wages or on slightly worse conditions if they were already on minimum wage, and using every trick in the book to, you know, slice and slice and slice away. Horrible, horrible stuff to hear, but that's the kind of level of competition, the kind of cutthroat level of competition you've got. I think it was cleaning jobs but she did a lot of different jobs, but I think that's the one that I'm talking about there, that particular
and here's
job
the thing, Mark, we do need a massive cultural shift. I'm not denying that. In fact, I'm very, very much in favor of having a massive cultural shift. Sometimes the way you do that is by bringing in one measure at a time. This is one measure that will make a noticeable difference to people's lives. Is it the only thing Labour government are going to do? No. But it's one measure. It's one part of a larger package that's you know, that we're working on. But this is a big measure, and it's a big important signal to business as to where our priorities lie.
Okay. Well, I can't deny that, and I agree that there does need to be a cultural shift. And actually, that brings us quite neatly to the last thing we wanted to talk about, which is another thing that Ed Miliband has set the political weather on, and it's energy prices, which have been in the news again this week. It feels like they're going to be in the news every week forever. So the reason it was particularly on my radar this week is because I happened to go to the Houses of Parliament to meet my MP, which was actually nothing to do with energy prices. It was for some other reason. But I happened to meet him just after he'd come out of the select committee, where they were supposed to have the big six bosses in. Actually, I think only one or two of the big six bosses turned up, and a couple of other bosses from smaller independent companies turned up as well. And they gave them a bit of a grilling. And my MP, Philip Lee, MP for Bracknell, is on that committee, and had a bit of a chat with him about it afterwards. And I think what he was telling me was probably in confidence, so I won't say it. But I think generally the feeling was that, certainly from what I'd seen reported on it, that perhaps the committee didn't really land any blows. Although I have to say, I'm not convinced that the job of select committee should be to land blows on people. I think really it should be to try and, you know, elicit responses and find out information and, you know, try and get to the bottom of what's going on with things. Now, sadly, I don't really think they managed to do that either, because I think the respondents were fairly slippery, although there was one chap, I think his name was Fitzpatrick, who worked for OVO Energy, who then seemed to do a lot of the media rounds afterwards, and I think people were generally very impressed with him, because he was basically challenging the big six bosses. You know, he was saying that he runs a smaller energy company and he cannot understand how they managed to come out with all these prices. But the fact that it is in the news, and I actually said this to my MP and his staff were there as well, and I was saying to them, because they were saying the reasons why it was important to do this, and they listed a few reasons, and then I kind of left a pregnant pause, and then I said, and of course Ed Miliband had his policy, and that's why it's such an important issue, and that's why we've suddenly had this select committee. And they all kind of nodded and then didn't really say anything. But actually that ties in with, I don't know if you saw a piece by Dan Hodges this week, where he said that he was speaking to a shadow cabinet member who said that there's an argument for saying that Ed Miliband is the most influential leader of the opposition there's ever been. And then listed
Dan
and
Rogers wrote that.
Yeah, he did. He was actually quoting
Good
a.
God.
And he said his instinct was to instantly rebut it, and then he thought about it and realised that he might be right. Because if you think about it, energy prices, it is because of Ed Miliband's speech that it
yeah,
is at the top
absolutely.
Of the agenda.
I'm just really surprised it's coming from Hodges.
Yeah, there's absolutely no denying that that's the case. But look what's happened with Syria. Because of what Ed Miliband did, the vote didn't go through for Syria. Then that then had a ripple effect that affected what happened in the US. And that then meant that actually the US couldn't launch strikes on Syria as a kind of, you know, indirect effect of that. And actually now what's happening is that the stockpile of Syrian chemical weapons is being decommissioned. Now, how many leaders of the opposition can say that they've managed to affect foreign policy to such an extent? And it all started because of what Ed Miliband did on the vote on Syria. And there are other examples as well. I can't remember the other two that he listed, but actually, I'm starting to wonder whether maybe he's right, and maybe Ed Miliband is maybe not the most influential, but certainly up there. And, you know, he's still got 20 months to go.
20 months to go, and then he'll be the most influential prime minister we've ever had. Who knows? Yeah,
we'll see about that.
But, yeah, I can't disagree with any of that. I think the Do Not Underestimate Ed Miliband Association, or whatever they called themselves, were quite right not to underestimate him. Mm. We are having this conversation about energy prices because of what I did at conference. We are continuing to have these kinds of conversations because what he's managed to do this year, last year in 2012, he made a conference speech that was widely lauded, but it didn't really go anywhere afterwards. That's not been the case this year. We've kept up the momentum on the living standards crisis. We've started on energy, kept the focus on energy. Now we're moving to wages. But it is very much, you know, it has to be said that Ed Miliband is leading our national political conversation at the moment.
Yeah, and it's a bit weird. I wonder why the Tories are allowing him to do it, because George Osborne had a little bit of a go at this in about 2007, didn't he, when he had the announcement about the inheritance tax, and that actually might be the most influential thing that an opposition politician has ever done in this country, because it forced Brown to not go to the country and then basically destroyed his premiership. But I'm surprised that the Tories haven't been more
stopping a war.
Well, okay. It depends how you look at it, because like I said, it was kind of an indirect ripple effect. And Ed Miliband couldn't have possibly known what was going to happen for that. Was I think Osborne knew exactly what he was doing, and it came off perfectly for him. But I'm surprised that the Tories haven't been more deft at dealing with him. It's almost like they're waiting to see what he does next and then reacting. I mean, I imagine that the government is going to do something about energy prices. I can't imagine they won't now. They're going to have to do something. I don't know what, and it can't be the same as what Ed Miliband has suggested. But I wouldn't be totally surprised if it was not a million miles away from it, just because it's clear it's an incredibly popular thing, and it's going to be in the it's going to be at the forefront of political debate from now until the election.
Well, they're going to have a very hard time doing something about it, given that David Cameron's been so forceful in the opposite direction. You cannot intervene in the market, although apparently they're talking about intervening in the water market. It's a price con, which doesn't actually mean anything. It's just some fancy words that Lyndon Crosby, who is now apparently going to be paid £500,000 a year by the Tories to do the successful job he's so far done of letting Ed Miliband run the political conversation. Keep it up, Lyndon. I think the honest answer is, and it's a weird answer because it's not the answer that most people, although I was saying it 3 years ago, but most people weren't saying this 3 years ago, is that actually David Cameron and George Osborne are not actually that good at politics.
Yeah.
They think they are, and they're very arrogant, and they won't listen to advice. So they don't hear the people who are telling them, you're not very good at politics. You know, there are plenty of people within the Tory party who get this a lot more. People like Robert Halfon, David Skelton, Lord Ashcroft, who if the Cameron clique were less circular and better able to listen to people who have different kinds of lives, different kinds of understanding of what the Tories need to do, but then they'd be a lot more successful. But actually, that's not who they are, and that's not how they do politics. They have a very fixed idea of what politics is about where politics... They believe that the politics of this country is in a fixed position, an unmovable position, and all they have to do is make sure that they're occupying that position. Whereas what Ed Miliband has tried to do, against quite a lot of resistance within his own party, is talk about shifting the political centre and actually taking that back to a populist, not hard left, but centre-left perspective. And, you know, if you look at some of the polling around some of the issues, there are plenty of people in this country, a majority of the people in this country, who are to the left of Ed Miliband on some issues. Nationalisation of the railways, for example. So I think that the truth is that David Cameron and George Osborne aren't very good at politics. They're very good at delivery, presentational politics. They aren't very good at actually working out tactics and strategy.
I think they're all right at the tactics. I think they're not so good at the strategy. And I think they share a lot in common with Gordon Brown in that respect. I think Brown was always good at the tactics, but his long-term strategy was rubbish, frankly, in a lot of ways. Certainly after he became Prime Minister anyway. And I do think there's too much short-term tactical stuff that goes on with this government. But
I mean, the other thing is Cameron had an extraordinarily easy ride as leader of the opposition. He kind of coasted for a really long time on having those short-term tactics, the huskies, the change in the logo. It was just assumed that there was a whole load of stuff behind that that just wasn't there. He is the Wizard of Oz. And has now employed the Wizard of Oz.
Okay, but to come back to the point about energy prices, I have discussed this in various forums, but I'm not sure if we discussed on this podcast about the specifics of the policy before. Because my feeling is it's very good politics, and we've seen the effect of that, you know, the fact that it is now at the forefront of discussion and it's a very popular policy and all the rest of it. But when it comes to the actual policy, it's just economically wrong-headed nonsense, isn't it? I mean, all that's going to happen is that the energy companies are going to, you know, either hike the prices up beforehand or they'll kind of swallow the hit for 20 months and then they'll just hike the prices up afterwards.
No, because what's been massively missed in all of the conversation around this is that the end of the sentence is not we will freeze prices for 20 months. It's we will freeze prices for 20 months whilst changing the market to better suit consumers. And actually, the point of the 20 months is not that that's how long you should freeze prices in order to help everybody out. It's that that's how long we think it will take to better regulate the market.
Okay. And is there any flesh on the bones about how they're going to do that? Because it strikes me that that is the sort of thing that the current government could actually have a stab at doing now.
I'm sure there is. It's not public yet. How they're going to do it, I don't know. We're talking about better regulation. I'm sure there are a million pamphlets out there as to how you do it, which one they opt for. They have not yet announced, and neither should they, if they think the government might steal their clothing on it.
Well, yeah, and I think because the government, like I say, are going to have to do something. And although they're not going to freeze prices, doing something about the regulation of the market is definitely an area I could imagine both the Tories and the Lib Dems could justifiably say, look, you know, the market isn't working properly. It's effectively an oligopoly, and therefore we're going to do this, this and this. And I think things like making it much easier for people to switch. So what Ed Davey was saying this week about people switching within 24 hours. And just as a little aside, I spent a couple of hours yesterday looking at what we pay for energy in my house, and then having a look at what deals are out there, and then going to Uswitch and doing the comparisons and then speaking to someone. And I am switching, and I'm surprised actually, because I was on a fixed deal with Scottish and Southern Energy, and I fixed it last year, last August. I'd forgotten I'd done that. And when I looked and realised I had a fixed deal, I thought, well, there's probably no point in switching, because if I fixed it before last year's price rise, once you take into account this year's price rise, surely there's not going to be anything on the market that can beat what I'm on. But I was wrong. There were about 15 different deals out there that would have been better than what I'm on. And the top deal, the top fixed deal that would have been fixed until, I think, June next year, was with a really small independent supplier. And I thought, oh, well, we'll go for that one. And after 20 minutes on the phone with the woman, who was all enthusiastic, can we do this? And she said, actually, Mr. Thompson, sorry, that's not going to work, because you're on a new estate and something to do with the pipelines and who owns the rights to the pipelines, and this particular independent supplier hasn't got access to that, and da-da-da-da-da. I am still switching, but unfortunately it's to another one of the big six, because they do have access to my pipes, and I am going to save a bit of money, but not as much. And also, I'm a bit miffed I can't switch to one of the independents. But it strikes me what Davey was saying about switching within 24 hours and making it much easier, and hopefully ironing out some of these anomalies, like some of the independent companies can't access pipelines to certain houses, because that seems like that's stacked against them as well, and that seems totally wrong. If they can iron some of those things out, maybe that could help. Maybe that's the sort of thing Labour would be looking at as well.
Quite possibly. I mean, I think the problem with the switching 24-hour thing is that when you switch is actually quite important, because if you're a customer of the first person to go and you suddenly are able to switch in 24 hours, you might switch to someone else who's about to go to be the next domino. It's bad advice to switch in the middle of a price hike frenzy.
Mm.
You need to wait until the price hikes have finished and then find out what's out there on the market and where everybody is and where everyone's landing.
Except that often what you get is the fixed deals that are available before the companies have put their prices up are lower, and you can lock yourself in for a year or 18 months, or in the case of the deal I went for, I think it's 20 months. And you can get that at a lower rate. If you wait until they've all come out with their price rises, then the fixed deals that are available suddenly aren't as good as the fixed deals that were available 3 weeks ago. So you've slightly shot yourself in the foot because you've waited. But this is part of the problem. It's like a three-dimensional chess game. And it shouldn't be like this. This is part of the problem. You shouldn't. And I'm a pretty switched-on consumer, and I was getting confused, and I was getting frustrated, and it took me about 2 hours. It shouldn't have taken me 2 hours as well. You know, it takes too long. And I was having to pull out old bills. I was having to compare what the rate is. And at one point it said kilowatt hours, but then another thing it said units, and I wasn't sure, is that the same thing? I had to look, I had to work it out. And in the case of the gas, it listed the kilowatt hours, but in the case of electricity, it listed units. It turned out that units are the same as kilowatt hours, but that wasn't clear. I had to Google that and work it out. It was a pain in the arse. And, you know, it should be much more straightforward than this. And it's in the end, the big six energy companies' interests for it to be this difficult, because that way inertia kicks in. People think, you know what, I can't be bothered. It's only an extra 20 quid a month. Sod it. I'll just leave it. You know, and that might sound a bit flippant, and 20 quid a month can be a lot of money, depending on your circumstances. But still, the fact that I think you're more likely to get divorced than switch your energy companies, or is that the bank? It's one or the other anyway. I wouldn't be surprised if it's quite similar. Shows, you know, just how difficult it is to do this, and how, you know, people are frightened of doing it. You know, they don't understand what they're doing, and they get confused, and they don't know what the best deals are, and they just don't do it. That needs to change.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree. And yeah, we do not have a market that works for ordinary people. We have a market that works for very rich shareholders of the big six energy companies. And that is not the right balance.
Mm, yeah. And, you know, I wonder if eventually the idea of taking it back into national ownership will start to rear its head if they can't sort this dysfunctional market out. Because it's only a real market if it's functioning correctly. If it's not, then you're almost at the point where you might say,
on nationalising utilities, it's actually really high in favour.
Yeah.
It's probably not going to happen, but you know, you're not out with the realms of the public opinion by saying that.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's strange, isn't it? Because maybe 5 or 10 years ago, that would have seemed quite an extreme position. Maybe it's because of what's happened with the banks and just the fact that years and years of 7, 8, 10, 12% price increases on energy have just led people to think, well, it wasn't this bad under British Gas. And it wasn't.
Mm.
Okay, well, on that socialist bombshell, maybe we should bring things to a close.
We should just mention that some people have had some particularly interesting times with their energy bills, just been announced this week.
Who's that?
Some RPs have been claiming their energy bills to quite a high extent. And yes. Interestingly, even some of the 2010 intake are the worst... worst culprits, which I found really interesting because they all came in off the back of, you know, the expenses scandal.
Yeah, is it Naheem's?
Nadine Sahawi is the one that, you know, it's nearly £6,000. He was elected in 2010.
Yeah.
He was elected in 2010 and was former co-founder of a polling company. Mm. Of all people, you'd think he'd get public opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I was on Twitter arguing about this earlier on because I said that, I mean, I saw this in the Mirror. I don't know if they broke the story, but it was certainly the link that I saw. And I mean, I'm not going to defend that one. £6,000 for energy. I mean, I know because I've just been looking at this yesterday, what we spend on energy, and it's a tiny fraction of that. So he must have a massive house that he's heating at taxpayers' expense. Or he leaves all his doors and windows open 24 hours a day. Either way, it's not acceptable for the taxpayer to be paying that amount of money. When you look down the list, it was only about the top five or six that were anything like that. It was like 5,800 for him, and then 4,600 for the next one, and then it was like 4,000, 3,000 for about another five or six, and then it was down into the like 2,000s and down into the 1,000s, which is far more reasonable. So I definitely think there's a question about the people who are spending that amount of money, but the tenor of the piece seemed to be that the public shouldn't be paying anything for the MPs' energy bills, and that worries me because this is going down that road. I think I tweeted that, you know, if the Mirror doesn't want the public purse to be paying for MPs' energy for the second homes and they should pay it for themselves. They should say that, but then they should understand that the potential consequences of that are that we could end up with a lot of MPs that they wouldn't like. And I think we do have to be quite careful here, because this is starting to go down the same thing as what happened with the expenses scandal. We get a lot of people who just say, oh, well, you know, they shouldn't get any expenses. Well, if you go down that road, you end up in a situation where the only people who can be MPs are those who are independently wealthy. And that's not going to be representative of the rest of the country.
No, I mean, I agree. I think there is a reasonable expense. I mean, I think the way that it's run is insane. I think including office staff costs into expenses is insane. Mm. I think that there are better ways of funding and managing running a second home, but it is absolutely vital, particularly for those MPs who cannot get to and from the House of Commons overnight. They need a place to stay. They need a place to rest their heads and, you know, have off time. And that shouldn't be, you know, if we don't support that, then all we'll get is independently wealthy people in the Commons. So it's vital that we do that. I just think that the way expenses have been managed is so bad. But also, it is just weird that there are people, even now, willing to just play the system so insanely, so obviously, so blatantly. And that's what causes these conversations to happen. You know, it's the same with the press. Of course we should have a free press. They should just behave like civil human beings. Of course we should have MPs who are able to live and work in London and have a presence in their constituency. They should just behave like civilised human beings.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I can't disagree with that. You know, like I say, out of 650 MPs, you've got about 7 or 8 or something who look like they're taking the piss. So about 1% or 1.5% of MPs. The rest of them are all either claiming numbers that are reasonable, and in the case of about 300 of them, not claiming anything at all. And I think they were listed in the Mirror's thing as energy saints. Well, that's not right. They're not saints. They're probably just wealthy enough to not need to claim, or maybe a lot of them
live in the Southeast Corridor.
Exactly.
Where they
don't have second homes because they don't have to have second homes. And the number of people who came on my Twitter timeline and were saying, "Why should MPs have a second home anyway? They should just have one home." It's like that's what you end up with when you have this kind of reporting. You know, people who just either they haven't thought about it or they just don't care. And one person said,
"It's not just the reporting. The people taking the piss bear the brunt of responsibility for these stories too."
Yeah, I'm not denying that, and I'm sure Cameron will be furious with Nadine, because you know £6,000 is you're back into kind of Duck Island territory with that. Yeah. That's the problem. But you know they need to nip that in the bud. They need to sort that out. Find out why they've spent so much. He'll probably have to repay £4,500 or £4,000 or something. I would imagine he should do anyway. You know, because the taxpayer shouldn't be having to pay to heat his mansion, which is what it sounds like. But no, I agree with you. But, you know, we need to be careful about this. Because I bet you, let's say in a year or 2 years' time, it's sorted out and the only MPs' energy bills are a maximum of 1,500 or 2,000, which, you know, reasonable amount for wherever they live. There will still be reporting like this. It will the Mirror will still splash with stuff like this. It's just they've... these few MPs have made the Mirror's job much easier because they can point to the ones that are clearly taking the piss.
Well, let's make sure, to bring it full circle, let's stop the press taking the piss and the MPs taking the piss, and hopefully we can all behave like civilised human beings.
Okay. Well, that sounds like a good point to draw things to a close then. So I'd just like to thank Emma for your time tonight.
Thank you, Mark.
And I'd also like to thank Audio Boot, who very kindly hosts the podcast on the internet for us. And I'd like to thank Kevin McLeod at incompetech.com for our theme music. And we'll be back next week.